Hello? 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 Hey, quiet! It's him again! The Mona!
Expanded his act. Could that be one person? No, Claire, that's the Mormon Tabernacle Choir doing their annual obscene phone call.
Hello.
This is Paul.
Hello.
Hey, everyone's here.
Hey.
Yay.
Is this your phone?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's a miracle. It's a Christmas miracle. It's
welcome
a Christmas
hotel
miracle.
Wi-Fi.
Yay.
Yes.
Yay. Hopefully the line will hold. Hold, line, hold. Oh, yay. It's a Christmas miracle. Awesome. I'm so glad we're
awesome.
Able to do this. Because
yay.
All right. So, yeah, let's get started. Happy holidays, everyone. This is going to be the part-time fanboy Christmas episode, which I'm very excited. I'm gonna upload this on Christmas Eve tomorrow. As of right now, it is Christmas Eve, December 23rd.
That's right.
We are here to discuss two fantastic holiday movies that we enjoyed this past week. The New Beverly Theater in Los Angeles did a triple screening of three horror holiday Christmas movies. They did Black Christmas, they did Silent Night, Deadly Night, and then they did the remake of Black Christmas. And all three of us were there to witness this wonderful event. We did not stay for the remake of Black Christmas. We're old. We're
some
too
of
tired.
Some of us have to sleep. I agree.
Exactly.
Yes, just we drew the line there.
Not going to do it. And we were also so blown away by the original Black Christmas that why ruin it? Why ruin it? So I am Christian Horn. I am on the line with Paul Edwards. And we also have Jay Holtham. And we all went to go see this fantastic, which, you know, thank the New Beverly Theater for doing this, because as soon as I heard about it, I got on the line with you guys and I was like, guys, we should do this. And you guys are like, let's do it. And what's interesting.
And it was wonderful, too. They were like beautiful 35mm prints.
Yeah. They were actually really good prints. The Black Christmas one was particularly impressive, I have to say. But you guys had never seen either of these or one of them?
Neither of them I saw.
Oh, wow.
I had not seen Black Christmas. I had seen Silent Night, Deadly Night, but it had been a long time.
Interesting.
I think we're talking like VHS.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And so like I didn't really remember a lot about it, you know, other than like, oh, yeah. I mean, there were literally just a few things that stuck out of my mind. I remembered, you know, okay, obvious, the Santa with the axe. I remember him chopping the head off of the snowman. shocked, like, because that just, like, really stuck out with me for some reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I, what I didn't remember though was like sort of how self-aware and funny it was as a slasher.
I think you're giving it too much credit. I think Jay and I kind of disagreed with you on that point. Like when we watched it.
I mean, definitely some of the humor is unintentional, but I think a lot of it was like legitimately trying to be funny.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is kind of a discussion that I have with some horror fans. Like I remember Cabin Fever, the horror movie that came out like several years ago, and it starts off as this like really kind of like interesting, kind of dark, gross horror movie, and then it slips into comedy. And I feel like that's sort of like a crutch that a lot of horror filmmakers start to dive into when they realize, oh, well, I don't have like a complete way to get out of this, or I don't know where I'm going, or I can't sustain the horror for an hour and 30 minutes or 2 hours. You know what I'm saying? But I don't even think that Silent Night, Deadly Night did that. I think it was just funny because it was just like, I didn't think they knew exactly what they were doing. You know what I mean?
It felt like they were trying because like I think they knew that they were being absurd.
Really?
Yeah.
Jay, you think
because
so
too? I mean, look what they were doing. Look what they were doing to this kid.
Yeah.
You know, they took every opportunity to like pile it on. It's like everything that could possibly, you know, like set him off, like they threw it at him. You know what I mean? Like literally I expected to like someone to paint a picture of Santa on a kitchen sink and throw that into it.
Exactly.
I mean,
I definitely felt that aspect of it. I felt that like we're full exploitation mode here. The guy who he didn't really write it. He sort of executive produced it and then lost control of it. Who was there at the thing and talking about it? Did seem to say like they were trying to make a shocking exploitation movie, and I felt like there is an aspect of it that is conscious of what it's doing. You know, that's like, oh my god, like can we make this any more sort of shocking?
Sure.
Right.
Like,
you know, it's not bad enough that like the Santa who traumatizes him, you know, rapes or attempts to rape his mother, but like the guy also just has to be a total dirtbag. We have to see him for no good reason shoot and kill a store clerk.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's just sort of, we're just dialing this all to 11 for the laughs.
Yeah. Well, it also was the 80s, right? I mean, this is sort of like the era of that sort of Death Wish and, you know, Friday the 13th and all that, like when it was the height of this kind of ridiculous murder exploitation stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that like came across that I know probably wasn't intentional, but kind of came out in an interesting way is this idea of maybe this being like almost like a psychological virus in a way that passes around, like that starts with like the grandpa and then goes to the kid. And then, you know, like that, you know, that it almost gets passed around, this idea of a killer Santa that's just never going to go away. You know, like there will always be this like sort of like dark undertone to the Santa thing, you know, especially now that we see with like the Krampus thing, you know?
Yeah. Wow, Paul, you just totally like, you reached out of the box and like you just like pulled a whole other element into this movie that I did not see. You've got an amazing imagination, like the Santa virus. Okay. If you are not writing that movie right now, then you need to be. I hope that you find yourself a cabin to seclude yourself in and be like, write the Santa virus, because I need to see that movie, because I didn't see any of that in this movie. I mean, obviously we're diving right into Silent Night, Deadly Night. I mean, I just saw, you know, what's really interesting to me is that I felt it was like as well produced as it could be. Like it didn't feel like I've seen a lot of slasher movies and I've seen a lot of zombie movies and stuff like that, that where the production value is like really bad. I mean, this kind of had like, I mean, the toy shop that, you know, spoilers for anyone who's never seen it. I mean, we should basically talk about the plot of Silent Night, Deadly Night, which is basically that there's this little kid on Christmas. He goes to visit his like senile grandpa, like on Christmas Eve or around Christmas time, and his family's driving home.
Who is the spookiest grandpa ever?
Yeah.
He's catatonic until he comes awake in front of the kid only to deliver a terrifying message about the evils of Santa Claus.
How Santa Claus.
Well, not necessarily the evil of Santa Claus, but like the idea that like Santa of like as like a punisher, you know? Like that he only rewards the kids who have been perfect.
Yeah.
And anybody else who's not, you know, like, you know, you're fair game.
Yeah.
It's so like American, you know. it's really like a sort of a terrifying vision, and you know, it does in a weird way like reach into something that like I didn't expect. That's like sort of scary. Mm-hmm. The idea of like, you know, you've got to be perfect all the time. You know, you've got to be nice all the time. You can't ever be naughty. Otherwise, like it's punishment for you. It's a very Calvinistic view of Santa.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, that you bring that up. Oh no, go ahead, Jay.
I was going to say that particular moment, that little speech about like Santa punishing people who are bad. Is like, you mentioned Krampus, and that was the first thing I thought of. I was like, oh wow, that is way more Krampusy than Santa Claus ever gets. Like any notion of Santa Claus ever gets them. Like that was super. Like okay, Santa punishes.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I mean, when, you know, like whenever you're dealing with like mythological, like you know, creatures or characters, it's like you know, Krampus and Santa are sort of like they're two different figures that represent like sort of the same side, and what this does is it puts the Santa and it puts the Krampus together into one figure, you know, and you know he either rewards you or he punishes you. It was just a really interesting view of Santa, and it's not anything I think that necessarily came across like again it that wasn't well thought out, but like this movie was almost successful in spite of itself in a lot of ways, and I think that's probably why it's got it such a longevity, you know? And you were talking about like how great it looks. It's like clearly, you know, clearly they shot it like sort of out in the middle of, in the middle of nowhere,
like
you know,
Utah.
they
say got like them. Utah, like the director was a Mormon or Utah. Something like that. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
It's set.
I wonder how much of, you know, I'm no Mormon authority, but I wonder how much like of, you know, of his sort of personal beliefs sort of influenced that, you know.
Oh, I don't know.
Can
I just say that the grandpa was the best actor in the whole movie, though, because like he stayed really still, and then when he delivered his speech, you were like, "Damn, grandpa's lost a screw." Like you thought he was crazy because he couldn't talk because he was catatonic, but then he starts talking to this kid in the most evil way possible, and there's a part of me that was like, "Why couldn't we have cast Grandpa for the Santa for the whole movie? Because that would have been terrifying." Because maybe Grandpa comes back when he's older or something, and maybe the kid is sort of like well adjusted at that point. Grandpa dies, Grandpa comes back. Dude, I've got a whole other movie called Silent
Night,
Deadly Night.
Evil Grandpa, dude, evil Santa.
Let's write this. Let's do it. Like seriously, like because that could have been a really good. You know, the kid grows up. He gets over his like fear of Santa, and then you know maybe goes to like, I don't know, a holiday camp, let's just go crazy. And he's meeting a girl and he's in love with her. And, you know, maybe it's a super religious. And then Grandpa comes back from the grave and is like, "You were not nice." Dude, come on. This is the best. We're going to make some money.
It's interesting, too, because like religion is all over that movie, you know? He's raised in a Catholic orphanage, you know? I mean, I thought it was interesting because it is one of the few like sort of Christmas horror movies that even addresses like the religious elements of the holiday.
Yeah, you know? You're right. Yeah. You're right. You're absolutely right.
But at the same time, I want to say this about the Mormon director. There's a sense of it when I was watching it that, like, and this is, you know, whatever, this is not to speak ill of Mormons, but they are relatively known to be prudish.
Yeah.
There is a sense that for the vast amounts of sex, that there are surprising amounts of sex.
Yeah.
And nudity in this movie.
Awkward stage sex. Yeah.
It's all super awkward, super uncomfortable, and clearly staged by someone who has neither had sex nor seen anyone ever have sex in their life.
Okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to kiss her chin, but don't open your mouth.
Absolutely.
It's so awkward.
Yeah. Well, the blonde in the cut off jeans in the middle of winter on the pool table, like, that was just like insane.
And who goes to the door topless?
Yeah, exactly.
There's a knock on the door, and she just goes right to it.
Yeah,
completely
topless, and you know, in the cutoff jeans. I mean, I don't know. I know we live in LA, and we're affected by the cold a lot harsher than other people. But I'm not going in cutoff jeans in like freezing cold weather. Like, and it's just like, it's just so odd because that whenever I see movies like this from the 80s and stuff like that, like, there's a thought, like, obviously things have changed so much in filmmaking and movies and the way that we see women and stuff like that. And I'm just like, oh my God, I hope that poor girl got paid a lot of money. Like, I really, because there's even like one actually really sort of, for a horror movie, impressive set piece where she gets like mounted on a set of antlers. Yeah. And I was like, that woman must have been completely naked during that whole, you know what I mean? And there's a part of me that's like, that's just wrong. Am I just not a Hollywood scumbag enough?
She made quite a career of that, honestly, though.
That's right. That actress
that's
is kind of
quickly, dude.
Yeah.
Leanne, you know, okay, that was
like, you know, a definite like horror, you know, icon. You know, her big role is Return of the Living Dead, right? Yeah. You know, she made a definite living doing that. You know, partially because of her willingness to do nudity.
Yeah.
Interesting. I just talked to an effects guy that I worked with recently, and he restaged that mounting on the horn with another actress. That bit just got recycled into another movie.
Wow.
And he was talking about like sort of the logistics of like, you know, how to pull that off and everything like that. It was really well done. It's a great looking shot. You've even seen that in Hannibal. They had a killer who, you know, and so interesting, like how sort of influential this little sort of no name, you know, movie became.
And
it was cool to have somebody there who addressed the controversy at the time I grew up in Hawaii. I don't even think we got the movie out there, but like I do remember like on the news talking about the controversy.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I was telling Jay about, I mean, I specifically remember the controversy. I mean, we grew up in like New Jersey, New York area, like that tri-state area. And I specifically remember Channel 4 News, I think it was Chuck Scarborough, and they're doing a report on like, oh, there's this new Santa Claus movie where Santa Claus murders people and blah, blah, blah. And people are protesting it, you know, in Times Square. And I remember I was raised very sort of, I mean, I went to Catholic school as a kid, and, you know, I remember thinking like, this is effed up. How could they do this to Santa? Like being like an eighth grader. Like, I think that's when it came out, when I was in eighth grade, and being sort of kind of like mildly outraged and then sort of like interested, like, wow, I kind of want to see that, but this is messed up. Like, this is so wrong. But I mean, you know,
You're like, how can no one have done this to Santa before?
Exactly. But I mean, so what ends up happening is his family's murdered. He's put in an orphanage, and he basically has, as any normal, healthy human being would, every Christmas, he is re-traumatized because Santa Claus comes to visit the orphanage and he can't deal with it. And the mother superior of the orphanage.
Yeah, it's almost like a Santa phobia, right?
Yeah, exactly. Which is
By the way, Santaphobia, great title also.
Yeah, that's a good one. But, you know, the thing is like any healthy child would be who went through that. But the mother superior of the orphanage is not having any of his nonsense when he freaks out around Santa. And she's basically trying to break him behaviorally of, you know, his fear of Santa. And then there's also a scene where he sort of discovers a couple of like older kids, I think, or helpers at the at the orphanage having sex, and the mother superior
That was kind of random. I was just like random people having sex in a room in an orphanage.
We were never introduced to before and never saw ever again.
They didn't have time to introduce us. And they probably didn't have the budget to pay like two. Well, I mean, they paid them to get naked, so I don't know. But anyway, my point is like, I think that sex thing sort of sets up the trigger for him. Like, it's sort of like the Hulk,
for sure.
You know, that the sort of Bill Bigsby green eyed, because as he grows up and he gets older, you know, he becomes like Red Brown, Captain America, acting ability included. He's not a very good actor, I'm sorry to say, but the guy is buff. He looks like Captain America, and he ends up working in a toy store. And sort of what helps set off his trigger is that, during one Christmas, Santa gets sick. Yeah, and then they end up dressing him up as Santa as a replacement, not knowing, dun dun dun, that this is a very, very bad idea. You know, so
or a great idea, depending on what you think about it.
Exactly.
The little killing rampage is amazing. Honestly, like, what surprised me was like the scenes like later in the movie where, you know, like the cops are looking for him and everything, and this group of orphans get someone dressed as Santa killed in front of them. Not once.
Blown away. Yes.
Twice the orphan sees Santa get shot.
That's right.
Right in front of them.
It reminded me a little bit of, you know, the scene in the Brood in the elementary school, in the Brood, where like, you know, the little kids drawing, it covers up the dead body and things like, I mean, it was just like, that was definitely like sort of a willfully shocking thing that you don't really see anymore in the movies. Like it's off limits to do like stuff like that to kids, you know.
Traumatized kids with holiday figures.
I mean, you know, but what's great is too, it's like, you know, it knew what it wanted to be. I mean, it was definitely, you know, it was a low budget exploitation movie with an eye on making a franchise, and you know, they definitely succeeded, you know, sort of beyond their wildest dreams, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is I actually think it's successful in its own way, because I actually saw this 2 years ago, maybe on DVD. I rented it and obviously watched it by myself after my wife had gone to sleep. And I remember even sitting there in the living room thinking like, huh, this was actually okay. Like, it was good for what it is. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it's a classic of horror cinema, but it's definitely one of those things that if you're a horror fan and if you, you know, want to see some stuff that's kind of like, you know, you're not crazy about the holiday season, or you're kind of tired of like all the happy, super go lucky, you know, holiday movies that kind of get foisted on everyone around this season, it would be a good watch. I mean, I thought it was, the first time I saw it, I was like, huh, this is good, which is why I wanted to go to the double feature, because I was like, I remember seeing it. Now with the crowd in the theater, I mean, it ends up being a much more rowdy kind of fun experience, because you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. I think it's definitely an audience movie, which is like sort of surprising too, because a lot of those movies were sort of made for like the home video experience by that time. Like,
sure.
You know, home video was starting to come into its own around that time, you know, so things started to become less, you know, meant for like the big screen, so to speak. And even though it's not like necessarily like an experience you have to see on the big screen, so to speak, I think it does benefit from audience a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it was a really fun movie to watch. And like you said, there ended up being a lot of like more humor than, I think there was more humor in the crowd than me watching it at home alone.
Like, yeah.
When I was watching it at home alone, there is definitely more stuff that, I mean, I obviously thought was silly, but when you're sitting with a crowd and other people are laughing, you start laughing along with it, and you're just kind of like, how messed up is this? How ridiculous is this? You know? The main character, what's his name? Is it, I looked it up, Billy. Right? Billy is played by Robert Brian Wilson. And he basically snaps because he's in the Santa suit. He's never had alcohol. And they sort of are like filling his head, you know, giving him drinks. And he doesn't really want to drink because he was raised sort of right, you know, by the nuns.
Mm-hmm.
And then the girl that he has a crush on, or who he's been having sort of illicit dreams about, starts making out with the mean stock boy or his supervisor in the back room.
Yep.
And then actually kind of like attempts to rape the girl. So he almost goes into like, it's really weird, Santa's superhero mode, because like not only does he kill the guy, but he strings him up with the string
the
of
lights.
And he saves her from getting raped. And then she's like, you're an animal. How could you kill him? And it's like, sweetheart, he was just going to rape you. Like, you know, you were screaming,
but it was
no,
the
80s no, no,
no.
But I mean, it's really weird because that sequence to me, being a superhero fan, like that's almost to me like the birth of the Santa Punisher, like sort of like Paul, Paul May. Like if he hadn't gone and just randomly, like if he had gone into the streets and started killing muggers with an axe and like other people, then this would have been an awesome vigilante movie. But Billy, unfortunately, goes unhinged and decides to just kill everyone. And that's when you're sort of like, you know, because like for a second there, he's almost like a hero. Like, I'm like, oh yeah,
right.
Except
for that kid in that great moment, she's like, I've been nice all year. And he gives her the box cutter and like as a gift. That was awesome.
Yeah, totally awesome.
Her look at it like, what?
Yeah.
But what is this?
I remember watching that movie and I was like thinking like, wow, in what universe do we live in where killing the rapist is the wrong thing to do? Like, I was just like blown away. And then obviously, you know, that's what kind of sets off his homicidal rage and there's no stopping him from there, you know, and some really good sort of like kill sequences, right? Like the bow and arrow. That was fantastic.
Sure,
Santa with a bow and arrow, which, Jay, you made an awesome comment like after we saw the movie, like a functional bow and arrow in a kid's department store.
I bought a functional bow and arrow from like a kid's department store back when I was a kid. Like that, like
well,
they
Utah,
did like a,
so.
Especially in like, you know, southern areas or midwestern, like you could go to like a store and like pick up, you know, like some toys and like a rifle.
You're right about that.
Which is true. But it's just like, it's again, I love seeing like old movie. Well, it's not this is such an old movie, but like older movies, because there is this looseness to the storytelling that just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Like with the people having sex. You know, those in a modern movie, we would definitely have to be introduced to those characters.
Yeah.
And they'd have to have a storyline that resolves. If for the bow and arrow to work, like at some point earlier in the movie, someone would have had to have pointed out that there was a bow and arrow store. In some way, it would have to come up. Because really, it's just like, this woman's running away from him. He's lost the axe. You think, oh, she's going to get away.
Yeah.
And he just pops up with a bow and arrow and shoots her in the back.
Yeah.
And you're like, where did that come from? I didn't even know that was a skill he had.
Well, you know, it was laying right next to the crawl board game on the shelf, which I spotted. They had some really great toys in that toy store for nerds. Like, I saw
Whole shelf full of Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah. Well, I saw the Castle Grayskull thing, and I was like, I used to have that. I love it. Oh, my God. Yeah, but also the shabbiest looking shelves of a toy store ever. Like, I was like, wow, I don't recall, like, them looking that bad, like toy store shelves. I mean, I remember KB toys.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was clearly like a warehouse, you know, that they decorated to look like the place, which is interesting. Like, everything else, I think, was like probably, you know, I mean, it seemed for the most part they shot almost everything like in, you know, practical like location stuff, you know, like they didn't do anything like on a set except, you know, maybe some of the stuff inside of a house or so. But I think that pretty much they just shot it, you know, in places that they had access to. You know, it's kind of, but yeah, they didn't like put their money into, you know, making it look like a believable toy store. That's for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely not. They definitely not. But it's really interesting. I mean, outside of the lead character, I actually really appreciated some of the acting. Like I loved sort of like the owner of the toy store. And I think that, that guy worked a lot.
Yeah.
In the 80s.
Yeah. I mean, I love that moment where he's, that moment where he closes up and it's like, you know, finally it's like, let's just get shit. You know,
he's had enough of the holiday season. He's like, I'm done with this. Christmas is over. Yeah. It's a great moment. It's a great moment. I mean, I think Jay, I don't think you liked the Mother Superior's acting, but I mean, she nailed it for me. I was like, I believe that she was like this evil sort of like towering nun figure that just felt like discipline was, you know, I thought they kind of nailed it. And I also really liked the younger nun who was like sort of looking out for the boys and girls, you know, the sort of Maria from Sound of Music who didn't want to be like, what's
two sides of Santa right there, the Punisher and the Protector right there. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Yeah.
You guys have gone way too deep into this movie. I was like, this is enjoyable as a grindhouse sort of mid-80s slasher film.
How it like sort of does these things again despite itself, you know what I mean? They clearly weren't aiming for a lot of this stuff, but it ended up happening for them, which, you know, was really lucky for them. Like the people who made that movie were like the luckiest SOBs. Like even like with the even with the protest, you know, like no one would have seen this movie if it hadn't been for the protests.
Yeah. It's really interesting though, because I mean, it is sort of that thing of like what's intentional, what's done by accident, and sort of like what subtext, you know, because like I know that Jay and I are sort of more willing to sort of like discount it like offhand and be like, this is just grindhouse. But you know, I also wonder a lot of times when somebody's writing a script or somebody is sort of directing a film, like what intent sort of like is in there that gets lost in sort of the muddle of like, because I'm sure that the guy who was writing this, you know, probably knew it was like a schlock job or whatever, but you know, as with every writer, you know, that you care about the material and you might sort of be wanting to put something in there. And sometimes that stuff like filters out, like what Paul is talking about. So it's really interesting. Like I'm always fascinated with this stuff because, you know, like one of the things like comic fans, you know, they start talking about like the golden age of comics and like, oh, comics sold by the hundreds of thousands and it was considered an art form. And I'm like, guys, Stan Lee has said like people wouldn't talk to him at parties. Like, let's not you know, like let's not make comics like in the 50s and 40s like this high art sort of thing, even though I believe that the artwork and the creators did make some wonderful material, but it wasn't seen like by that, like at the public at large. And I think that that sort of happens to horror movies, you know, after they're out for a little bit. I think there's a crowd that sort of like falls in love with these things and not that they're looking for stuff, but find stuff that maybe upon initial release, like wasn't there. You know what I mean? I find that stuff fascinating. Right.
Here's the thing is that like, you know, Silent Night, Deadly Night, you know, for it was fun, it was entertaining. It's not a great movie.
No.
You know? Mm-hmm. But Black Christmas, man, that's a great movie.
Yeah. Black Christmas.
Like, yeah. Black Christmas is legit good.
Yeah.
I mean, like it was just really interesting to see those two sort of back to back. And I'm glad we saw them in the order we saw them in too.
Yeah, me too.
You know.
Yeah, they played, doing the reverse. They played Black Christmas first, and then they followed it up with Silent Night, Deadly Night. We just delved into Silent Night, Deadly Night first, and now we're going into Black Christmas, which is totally fine with me, because Paul is right that out of the two, and probably the three movies that screened that night, Black Christmas is the more superior choice of all of them. And it's really interesting because when we went to go see it, and I sat in the theater, you guys saw it for for the first time, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it. They show it on Turner Classic Movies, like around the holidays, like as like one of their like grindhouse, like midnight movies. And I've seen it, I think the first time I tried to watch it, I was tired and I fell asleep in front of the TV. And then I watched it and I liked it, but it didn't sort of like hit me or blow me away or anything like that. In the theater, it plays so much better. Like, it is great in the theater. Like, I was blown away by like so many of like the camera transitions, so many of the things that the editing stuff, so much of the acting, like Margot Kidder and, you know, some of the sort of secondary actors. I mean, you know, Olivia Hussey, she was okay, but
she's okay.
You know, I think a lot of the other actors surrounding her were, you know, John Saxon. I think everyone just nailed it with this movie. And obviously this, and, you know, like Jay saw it for the first time, and he's like, Halloween basically like clips so much stuff from this movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Absolutely. Yeah. Like, Halloween is essentially a remake of this movie.
Yeah.
Which is just, it's weird that I've never seen it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really interesting because, I mean, we'll talk about the story a little bit, that, you know, essentially that it's basically a bunch of women who live in a sorority house, like a college, and they're getting creepy phone calls, like, you know, perverted sort of breathing and scary noises. And what's interesting is how, like, in the theater, how much, I remember sitting in my living room and thinking that was creepy, but in the theater, like, that comes through, like, so much more powerfully. Like, the sound is fantastic.
Yeah,
the sound design in the movie was really good. And I mean, and it's, and those, dude, those phone calls were obscene phone calls. Like, you know, like they were, I mean, they were, they went like really over the top, you know, in a way that, like, I haven't seen a modern movie. Like, I mean, granted, like, you know, the obscene phone call in a way is a thing of the past because of caller ID and, you know, all this other stuff. And it's interesting even like that they have a joke regarding like basically phone exchange, you know, phone exchange numbers, because the FE, you know, 967, you know.
Like, that's right.
You know, there are some dated, some things that are dated, but in a way it's like, man, they work better and made it more suspenseful. We were talking about, like, you know, since it's all mechanical, like the relay switches where they're trying to do, at one point the police try to tap the phone to trace the call. And there's a guy whose job it is to, like, sort of run down these lines of switches to try to find, like, which relay is being used and, you know, trace it back and everything. And it was really suspenseful, so much more than, you know, like, somebody sitting on a laptop, you know, with a headset, you know, saying, you know, hold up, keep them on the line longer.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Watching the computer screen sort of cycle through or whatever, or cursor blink.
Yeah, it was, I mean, there's like,
it really added to
physical
it.
Movement. And yeah, it made a big difference. Like, I really, that was one of the things I sort of wasn't expecting, was just like how, like, once it sort of turned, there are moments where it sort of turns into a police procedural kind of thing, you know? And those are really suspenseful and well done.
Yeah.
Bob Clark, the director, like, you know, is famous for Porky's, also for Christmas Story and everything. One of the things I was like looking at, it's like, you know, in all of his movies, like, people have like jobs, and like,
so much of the
things are like directed around like what people do and how their job is. And usually their jobs suck and they don't really kind of like them or anything like that. And it makes the characters like so much more relatable, you know?
Yeah. Well, you also made a really good point about directors, period, that night. And I would like you to talk a little bit about that, because what you said was, and I found this to be really fantastic, is that, you know, back in the 80s, maybe 70s, directors weren't just like locked into one genre, sort of like they almost are now. Like, they would make a variety of movies. I mean, we're talking about a guy who made Porky's and then Christmas Story. You know what I'm saying? Like, you made a really good point.
Yeah, he was able to, you know, sort of like jump all these different genres. I think he followed it up, you know, this was a slasher, and then the one he followed up with was the one that they showed the preview for that night, Breaking Point, you know, which is sort of like a Death Wish style, you know, revenge, you know, thing. I mean, he's just, he has like such a very like eclectic, you know, just style, you know, like he mm-hmm. would tackle every genre, but like he was so like dead on with the acting. Like one of the things that like I feel directors now tend to treat actors almost like, I don't know, like a special effect almost, uh-huh. you know, like the actors in these things, in certainly in Black Christmas, I mean, every single one of them just sort of felt right, you know?
Yeah.
They had their own like backstory and everything felt like really like related and, you know, lived in. Kyra DeLay, you know, like as that crazy concert pianist boyfriend, you know, who's a suspect for a while. Like, that's a great character, you know?
Well, Margot Kidder, first of all, like Margot Kidder, like I have to stop and talk about her because she was awesome in this. She's sort of that raunchy, like foul mouthed friend that you have. And then there's that one moment in the movie because she kind of like bullies another girl in the beginning. And you sort of get the feeling that she's a little bit of the mean girl. And then she sort of makes that joke with the cop about fellatio, whatever, you know, that these phone exchange line is fellatio and he's kind of clueless and she's getting a kick out of that. And she sort of comes a little bit across as the mean girl, but the scene right before she's going to get offed, where she has an what's her face? Olivia Hussey is downstairs and then she hears like a gasping and you're thinking that, oh, this is it. Margot Kidder's getting killed. And she runs upstairs and she's basically like in the middle of an asthma attack. Like to your point about making the characters real and like sort of three dimensional, like that is the moment where you're like, this person is not just some cold, like invulnerable, like hard case. Like I'm just going to make fun of everybody.
No.
Like it's a very sympathizing moment and it makes her so real. Like I love that bit, and then within a couple of minutes,
and she's clearly, she's clearly the smartest one of her friends too.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like she's rich. You know, she's richer than the rest of them. She's smarter than the rest of them. You know, like you really like get where she's coming from, and like even when she's being like mean, you understand her. You know?
Yeah. And that that's sort of like the, you know, in our previous podcast about like Rogue One, that's sort of like what was missing, you know, for me from that movie, is that like each of these girls had little moments, but they were different enough and they had little sort of tiny bits of dialogue that you felt for them. Like you felt for Olivia Hussey, you felt for Margot Kidder, especially when they're set up with this sort of like really weird. I mean, these phone calls are really disturbing. I mean, if I got them, I would
really
be
really upsetting.
Yeah. I would be like, holy cow, like this is just messed up. And, you know, and as the movie goes on, you know, obviously the co-eds sort of start to get offed one by one. And the thing that none of them know is that the sort of intruder is like living in the attic and like pulling their bodies up into the attic as he goes. But like, Paul, you totally nailed it, because like, for me, the thing that really hit it beyond like Bob Clark's, you know, and the cinematographers, like whoever the cinematographer was, like really great and editing, like great transitions. Like it was the fact that it's like, you kind of knew who all these girls were like right off the bat. And then as they get killed, you're actually sort of like, oh wow, that sucks. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, they don't necessarily get killed off in the order that you're expecting them to, you know? And then the fact that like, you know, that like what's great too, is that like people do note, I mean, you know, one of the jokes, you know, it's like a joke is in one of the police officers, you know, is clearly sort of incompetent. You know, he's just there to sort of push paper around, and he's not as smart as everybody, you know. And, you know, like what's great is like they call him out on it too. Like there's that great moment where John Saxon, you know, like basically is like, hey, you know, we traced this obscene phone call, you know, to this address, and this is the same address somebody, you know, disappeared from. Don't you think that like that's something we ought to check out?
Yeah. That's a really great moment.
You know, like it I loved the workplace dynamic in that police station. Because like, you know, the cops were there, like they're doing their jobs, you know, but like half the time they spend just sort of busting each other's balls and like laughing at each other, you know, because you know, everybody knows that everybody knows each other, you know, it's kind of fun. You like, that's one of the things that's interesting too, is that there's just this sort of weird element of fun going through the movie. Like, even though it's dark and the movie gets really dark and like awful, like there's still a lot of fun through it. Like the house mother smuggling her booze everywhere, you know, like,
Can we talk about her? Can we talk about her for a
second?
She's
incredible.
She was amazing.
Oh my God.
Her name's Marion Waldman. I guess she was a character actress for a long time. And the thing is like, again, on TV, that stuff for me just did not ring as funny as it did. But when you're in the theater with a lot of people, and I think a lot of these people may not have seen this movie before either, like, she nails it. Like, she is the comic relief, and she's hysterical. She is very much...
She's, like, really...
so funny.
Like, sort of, yeah, she's, like, big, and she plays it very broad and, like, over the top, but, like, not too far, you know, in a way that like only sort of actors of that generation were really able to do. You don't see that style of acting very much anymore.
Yeah.
But like when you, but holy cow, she was a master of it.
Yeah.
That was a great role. And like, that's what's kind of the interesting thing too about it is that like that these actors were so good at like taking these roles and, you know, really making the most of it without like necessarily calling attention to themselves. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't like, this is my movie. You know, now if you see a performance that's kind of showy in a way, it's definitely like meant to call attention to like that actor. Like, hey, look at me. Hey, look at me. It didn't come across that way. It was like everybody had their moment, but it all fit together in, you know, in the whole, really great ensemble work.
Yeah,
know?
It really is a great ensemble really piece. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like they all sort of bounce off each other. Like Olivia Hussey is obviously the central character, but there's just so many other people like doing such great work around it. And you can tell it's sort of like a low budget production. I mean, I don't know if it's because when it was shot, you know, or, you know, apparently.
Well, it's a Canadian production.
Yeah.
You know, they were, you know, it's in a small town.
Yeah.
You know, but wow. I mean, they made that place look amazing. Like you really, one of the interesting things too, is I got a really good feel for the geography of the town in a way too. Like the town felt like a real place too.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't feel like, A lot of the problem with a lot of like slasher movies and like, you know, little smaller horror movies is that like you never really know where you are. You know,
it's
just like, okay, we're in the interior of a house, you know, and this house is somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you actually get out of this place. You see the police, you know, you spend some time on the college campus, you spend some time like, you know, around the town, and it makes a big difference. And one of the things that you pointed out, Christian, that night too, was like how, like, there were very few moments where like you ever look at it and you're just like, oh my God, like, I can't believe they're making this decision. That's ridiculous.
That's
the stupidest thing a person could do. Like, the example you did was that, you know, the Christmas carolers, there's a scene where a group of kids are out Christmas caroling and singing this, song. And, you know, and Olivia Hussey is like standing in the doorway, you know, where you were the director, just said, okay, you just stand here and look great. You know, we'll light you great.
Yeah,
you
yeah, yeah.
This, you know, and you know, and this is right after, you know, a kid was found murdered in the park.
Yeah.
I know I was thinking, and you were thinking, it's like, there's no way these kids would be out, you know, after a child was just murdered. But then right after they're done singing, like somebody runs up, like, hey, you got to go home. You got to get out of here now. And you're just like, wow.
You know?
Like,
yeah.
Like they tied up like, anything that seemed like it was going to be a loose end got tied up, you know, which is,
you know, what's funny,
except for the fact that it's all loose ends. Like, that's the other great thing that I love about it. And it's so interesting to see this in comparison to Silent Night, Deadly Night, because this is essentially the first slasher film.
Yeah. Yeah. This right? is credited this is, this as is, sort of like the one that set it all off in a way. Yeah. But I think it was really Halloween.
First,
yeah.
But I mean, but Halloween comes after this, and Halloween just steals from it.
Yeah, no,
liberally.
Absolutely. No, I'm saying that this is credited as the first, but Halloween, I think, started the craze.
Definitely,
you know what
the first.
I mean?
Let's call it the first American slasher film, because I think there are a lot of elements of this that I saw that seemed to be borrowed a little bit from like Italian giallos.
A
little bit previous to this, but it's kind of contemporary with a lot of like Argento's earlier stuff, though.
Yeah.
So,
well, what was your point,
we can call
Jay?
It the first American slasher.
Yeah,
but yeah,
sure.
but looking at this, and then you compare it to Silent Night, Deadly Night, and like, it's, you can see how those aspects are so watered down, and in its place are things of are like, even though the storytelling is still pretty loose, like the murder of the girl is never fully solved. The murderer's identity is never fully, not even fully, is never confirmed in any way. It begins with this great point of view shot of just someone sneaking into the house.
Yeah.
And then the calls come in, but it's clear the calls have been coming in before. So we don't even know if it's really the same person. If their caller is the person who broke in, or if it was someone else who'd been calling them and then this person was called. There are all these sort of like weird sort of like not exactly dead ends or loose ends, but these things are just left completely ambiguous intentionally.
Well, it's interesting that you say that.
And it's great because, like, I really had the interpretation of, like, oh, this is somebody who was, like, a previous occupant of this house.
Oh,
like, they
maybe.
Seem to know the house. They understand it, you know. Like, maybe it's somebody who lived in the house before, you know.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's a really good point, too, Paul. The one thing that, and kind of going back to what we were talking a little bit before, but in a way, and this is sort of like a very 70s movie thing to say, it felt like life. You know what I mean? I mean, it felt like you're not going to get any clear answers. Like nobody has, like, obviously there's one big subplot, you know, in it where Olivia Hussey's character is pregnant and she wants to have an abortion. And the one thing, and this has nothing to do with that abortion thing, but the one thing that I really felt, or I felt watching this movie, and it goes back to Paul's point about it being a community, and I mean, it, like, knowing where you are in the house, or and kind of knowing where everyone is like, I really felt like they were in a community. Like, I felt like they were, they were like, that they all kind of knew each other, like this person, or when they met each other, you know, they have that scene where they're going to go search for the dead girl's body through the park, like with the dogs, and you see all the neighbors come out, and you see, like, everybody coming out to help them. You see when they go into the police station, like everyone's kind of talking to each other, and they kind of know each other, or they know what school they went to. Like they did a really good job of like sort of establishing the fact that there's a community and that these people are sort of decent to one another and like get along. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah,
and,
totally. They like stick up for each other. I mean, like literally, like, you know, like when the boyfriend, the first girl who's murdered, her boyfriend is like an immediate suspect, and like all the girls are like, you know, no, like there's no way she was seeing anybody else. That's not in her character.
Yeah,
that's not
exactly.
Yeah,
she is, exactly. You know? Exactly.
Yeah, like, and he like, totally knows the detectives, and like they vouch for him. He's
the guy
who gets
the
really to take him seriously.
The investigation.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I mean, there's
because,
none of
like,
that.
No one's treating it seriously.
Well, I mean, there's none of that stuff that happens in like movies today where it's like somebody's a suspect and it's automatically everyone's like, oh my God, he must have done that. You know, he was kind of creepy that one time at that one party.
Right.
You know what I mean? There's none of that.
For sure.
Everyone's sort of just like, and maybe it's just a sign of like a more innocent time or whatever, but it's also sort of a thing that I really felt was like a thread through this whole movie and why you sort of felt it whenever like a girl would get chopped off. I mean, like, let's face it. Like, and once the Friday the 13th movies take off, you're sort of just like, they're just like, you know, dolls. Nobody really cares. But in this movie,
they're cannon fodder. Dude.
Yeah. In this movie, especially and this is another thing that I really wanted to point out. The first girl who goes missing is supposed to meet her father, and her father, she never shows up, and her father starts going looking around, and the actor who played her father, he was great too, because you could see he was worried. You could see he was mm-hmm. he was very concerned. He never delves into like histrionics. He never delves into like, no. Look, you need to find my daughter. There was none of that. But he has like little tiny moments where you look at his face and it's like, dude, this guy's falling apart inside. And then you have another moment at the front desk at the captain where I can't remember exactly what was happening, but somebody's ignoring one of the girls, or like the cop is kind of or makes an insult or like tries to blow somebody off on a comment, and the dad comes up and he says something like, you know, that's not necessary, or he's like, we're gonna figure this out. Like, he, in the middle of like what's going on with him, has business to help somebody else. And I'm like, man, that just shows, like, to me, like how much they're sort of all sort of coming together as a community, as opposed to like the way movies are kind of, horror movies are made now. It's like everyone's out for their on their own. Like, nobody, get the feeling these days.
And that's interesting, because I do want to see the remake. I mean, there's no way I could have stayed awake for it at the time. But I do want to see the remake to see what different choices they made. I mean, in a modern movie, like, immediately, her boyfriend would immediately then become the main character. You know, now this movie is about him.
Right.
Or the dad. Like, the dad, now it's his movie. You know, like, and with this one, it's like, no, like, the main characters of this movie are still going to be the girls in that house.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? Yep. I just had a thought. Like, I think that what I'm feeling from this movie is a little bit of that Christmas warmth. Like, they fit it in there. Like it's a horror movie, but there is that sort of like holiday glow to it, as messed up mm-hmm. as it is to say. Like, they did capture sort of like a Christmas feel, like, where, you know, there's, you know, it's lit very orange, very red, very sort of like warm, you know, palette. And it sort of like envelops you in the sense of this holiday feeling. But at the same time, there's all this messed up stuff going on. So you have like this like warm glow. But at the same time, it's like, no, this doesn't compute. There's like perverted phone calls and girls are going missing in the park. And like, this isn't the way it should be. Like, I don't know. They just did a really great job of establishing atmosphere. Not necessarily like terror or fear, which is there, but there's also this atmosphere that just works like really well with the holiday season. Man, Bob Clark's a genius, man. Yeah. He was firing at all cylinders.
And without ever feeling like arch, we were talking about with Silent Night, Deadly Night, like, it never feels like it's making fun of Christmas.
Yeah.
Or it's like trying to take the piss out of Christmas, or even trying to be like, oh, we're being super shocking.
Yeah.
About this, in a way, outside of just sort of like general good filmmaking practices. Like, we were talking about the carolers who come to the door. While the carolers are at the door, Margot Kidder is upstairs being murdered.
Yeah.
And it, one, serves the like plot point of she doesn't hear her screams because the kids are singing.
Yeah.
So she doesn't really understand what's happening behind her, but it's also that, like, the juxtaposition, but in a good artistic way, juxtaposing the beautiful caroler singing with the violence of the murder, that just works so well.
Yeah. Well, it's really, and it's also, go ahead.
No, I was just saying too, like, just how well staged every mm-hmm. attack in this movie is.
Absolutely.
I think it was like after the first one, I mean, it's edited so well and so, like, shocking. I was like so impressed.
Yeah.
You know, I remember like from that moment, I was just like, wow, like, that was really well made. And it comes from sort of from nowhere. You know what I mean? Like, it's suddenly like, you know, it, like, the movie's really interesting up to that point. But then, like, after that first attack, it becomes incredibly suspenseful. And, you know, it just, it never stops from that point on. It just keeps building mm-hmm. and building and building. This was an incredible, like, revelation. I'm I'm surprised that like it stayed off of my radar for as long as it has, you know? Well,
yeah, it's interesting to your point about the scenes where the ladies are all murdered. Like, I brought up the point, you know, Margot Kidder is sort of like the bawdy, like making fun of girls because they haven't had sex yet. And like, she even has a point where she's like the first girl that kills, she makes fun of her for being a virgin or whatever. And then when Margot Kidder gets killed, there's these glass unicorns on her like bedside or by her bed or on the mantel place or whatever, like right by her bed. And as she's being killed, she's like reaching up for these like glass unicorns and they're kind of like shattering. And I think she even gets killed with one, right? Stabbed with one.
I remember thinking,
and I think I actually said it to you guys that night, was like, you know, the unicorn is like the mythological figure that only virgins can see, right? Like, she's like making fun of like,
or can only they can touch.
Only they can touch or whatever. You know, I think it was legend, Ridley Scott's legend or something that may have pointed that out. But, or, you know, and from what I know, that's sort of like a thing that is a part of mythology. But I remember thinking like after that kill went down, being like, wow, did they think of that? I mean, there has to be a reason that unicorn, I mean, you don't just put a glass unicorn, like there's no way that the set decorator.
Aside from the fact that it made everything look spectacular during that scene. Animals and the light going through. I mean, that was the shot. I remember like watching that. I'm doing like, dude, whoever did this has seen Argento. You know what I mean? Whoever was the DP, and I didn't look him up, I should, but like, it's like, okay, clearly that's a person who was aware of like what was going on in cinema outside of the U.S. at the time. Because like some of the shots in it are so like Italian looking. And there's the difference between Black Christmas 2 and Silent Night, Deadly Night, is that with this one, if you see like, okay, we've got the unicorns here, it's like, well, did they do that intentionally? I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt on this one. So yeah, they probably did.
They must.
Whereas Silent Night, Deadly Night, it's probably like, yeah, that was a happy accident.
Exactly. Actually, the cinematographer's name is Reginald H. Morris. He died in 2004, but he also did Porky's. He also did A Christmas Story, Murder by Decree. Looks like he had a really long career up until about 1990. Yeah. The guy knew what he was doing. He also did Porky's 2 the next day. You know, Turk 182.
Well, it's interesting how much of Clark... Clark liked to reuse a lot of his actors and work with people that he'd worked with before. And man, like I was just so impressed from like start to finish with that movie. It's you're right, Christian. It's not just a good movie. It is a good holiday movie.
It does
capture some of that Christmas spirit.
Yeah, you know, it's really funny because I really do think like this is one of the better horror movies I've seen, and it really points out like, because I remember like you guys know I'm like huge into zombies. Like, I love zombies. I always loved Night of the Living Dead. I mean, I was always a big fan of it, right? But you know, I always kind of like wrote it off and like low budget, you know, but I loved it for my own reasons until I saw it at the New Beverly and they had a beautiful pristine print. And I'll never forget the memory of like sitting in the theater, watching this movie, nobody's jeering, nobody's saying anything, dead silence, everybody, you could feel people being creeped out and looking around in the theater and like just the look on everyone's faces. And I was like, damn, this is an effective movie. And if anything, Black Christmas to me, it reminds me of why, I mean, I don't know about today. You know, today there's certain movies are being made for widescreen TVs and all that stuff and HD and stuff. But I mean, there's definitely movies that are so much more powerfully effective on the big screen in the dark. It doesn't even have to be a full theater, but with people, there's just something about that communal experience that as much as I poo-poo it being a dad and not being able to get a sitter and being like, whatever, I'll just watch on my big screen. I don't care. I am one of those people sometimes. But this is just one of those reminders.
No, I think you're right, because it's interesting. I mean, if you look at any sort of like tentpole, you know, franchise movie, you're going to have, I have the same experience watching something like that on the big screen as I do at home.
Yeah.
Like, I get the same experience, you know, something like this, you know, like, and I can't, I can't put my finger on necessarily what it is, but there are, you know, some movies that it's just like, well, you've got to see it with an audience. Yeah. If you don't see it with an audience, you're missing an integral part of what makes it so good.
Yeah. You know, I love this so much that I think if they do it next year, I would go again. Like, I really, I kind of want to watch it again, you know, like,
I mean,
I really, really enjoyed the experience. I mean, if you're in L.A. or you live in L.A. or whatever, you should definitely check out the New Beverly because, I mean, there was a time where I was going down there a lot. Like, I live in the Valley now, like on the outskirts of the Valley. So it's harder to get down there. But like the Egyptian Theater, this, the Arrow Theater over in like Santa Monica, like they're just great places to go see movies. And if you're visiting L.A. or you live in L.A. and you don't go or you don't know about them, you should, because like this is the and the greatest thing about the New Beverly is they renovated it, but like, because I was like, did they renovate it? It kind of looks the same, but they renovated it to look like an old sort of like 80s, you know, like movie theater. I mean, the seats are still comfortable, but you know, I don't know.
Yeah, but it's still got like that old, like sort of the patterns and like the textures and everything are still those old things. It's not meant, it's not slick. It's not, you know, elegant. It's like, you know, it's a movie, you know, it's a movie house, you know? And that's one of the things that's really enjoyable about it. And and it definitely made me like appreciate Bob Clark a lot more.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, I've always loved A Christmas Story, you know,
me too.
But this is now, I mean, after that, I was just like, wow, you know, like, I'm going to go see Breaking Point. You know, I'm going to look at some of these other movies.
I want to rent Porky's. I haven't seen it in ages.
I want to re-rent Porky's. I definitely want to see Turk 182 again.
Yeah. Oh my God. That thing was on HBO all the time. When that trailer came up, I was like, oh wow. Robert Urich was the brother, right? That got injured. And then, my God. And that's like, that's kind of Turk 182. I mean, to go off on a tangent, that's sort of like right up there with what we're going through today, where it's like, why aren't we taking care of our, you know, first responders, you know, or our soldiers? Like, yeah, I'm gonna have to watch that again. Maybe we should do a Turk 182 podcast.
I would love it. That would bring me so far back.
I know, me too.
You know what, man? Christian, really quick, like, what number podcast are we on?
I think we're 184, 183 or something like that.
Too bad.
I know, we totally missed it. I'm sorry. But yeah, we're way ahead. So it'll have to be Turk 185 or Turk 186 or something like that for us. But yeah, no, Bob Clark gets so much more respect for me at this point. Like, for him to be able to make like all these movies. And, you know, Paul, you totally nailed it on the head. I mean, I wish today's directors were more like that, where they were doing sort of like, here's your sort of like period piece, here's your weepy drama, here's your comedy, here's you know, there's something to be said about, you know, artistry like reaching off into like other places besides just one genre. So I don't know.
Yep.
But in any case, I love Black Christmas. I did enjoy Silent Night, Deadly Night, but I loved Black Christmas, especially in the theater. If you ever get a chance to see this in a movie theater with an audience, do it, because it will creep you the heck out. I mean, I was watching it and I was genuinely like, this is effed up. Like, whoa. Those phone calls shook me to the core. Like, I was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember sitting in my house still being like, looking around like, oh my God, that's a creepy phone call. So in the theater, it was like magnified tenfold. So any final thoughts on Black Christmas or Silent Night, Deadly Night?
No.
Nope. We're all good?
Nope. No, right, I don't think so. I just had a great night, and it was cool seeing a movie with you guys.
Yeah, it's great. We got to do it more often. Yep. So anyway, happy holidays, everyone. Thanks for making it through 2016 with us. I'm not quite sure that this is our last podcast for the year, because we may do the Doctor Who Christmas special, but that may have to wait till after New Year's, depending on when we can get Barry Negrin on the podcast, because he's going to be on vacation, la-di-da. taking a vacation. But thank you for listening in 2016. Hopefully we will be even bigger and better in 2017. And everyone have a happy holiday. And hopefully we will all survive the new year. And thank you for joining me, Paul Edwards and Jay Holtham. I really love talking nerd stuff with you all year round. And I cannot tell you publicly enough how much I love you guys, because I consider you some of my best friends. And it's just always great getting together with you guys. So Merry Christmas to you guys, too.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yay. God bless us, everyone. Follow us on Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. Yay, commerce. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Part-time fanboy.
Punish!